Yeah, you can imagine my degree of skepticism when I was asked by Boris to come up here and take an hour to teach a room full of astrophysicists and also biology postdocs, graduate students and professors, everything about developmental biology. There could be no worse audience, because the astrophysicists will be filled with questions that I can't answer, and the biologists have all heard this before. So we're going to be talking about organismal development in plants and animals. The examples we have will be specific plants and animals. It's not always that way. There are always exceptions. And so if you don't raise your hand and tell me you know one that does it a different way, because I know one too. What happens in development is you begin with a fertilized egg. In the example of a human, amazingly, there are a couple of seats up front, people want to sit down. Amazingly, that egg has been sitting for 20 or 30 or 40 years at body temperature in first meiotic prophase. It finishes meiosis and then is fertilized, and it goes from a single cell by continual divisions to about 5 times 10 to the 13th cells, which are organized in a variety of different levels of patterns. First of all, there's cellular differentiation, whereby the cell, the daughters of the original egg cell, come to have different activities, different morphologies, different metabolisms, as a result of changes in gene expression. So the egg has in it a template, or at least a parts list. It's often called a blueprint, the DNA. It's not a blueprint. It's like when you get that IKEA bookshelf and you get two things with it. You get a parts list and you get the assembly instructions. This is the parts list. You don't get the assembly instructions with DNA. And so it's a one-dimensional code. In addition, there are other templates in an egg. There are proteins, which will serve as positions for protein machine assembly, self-assembly. There are lipid bilayers, which will serve as templates for additional formation of lipid bilayers. So all of the information, all of the templating isn't in the DNA, but most of the information is in the DNA. And the cells can be very similar, the DNA different, and it makes a difference between being a worm and a human. So cell differentiation is when the DNA changes the genes that are active and therefore the array of proteins that are present in the cell. And we won't be talking about that because it's what Boris disparagingly calls a list of scalars, because it's just a bunch of genes and how much they're expressed, and indeed that is all it is. And we'll be talking about the two processes that occur after cell differentiation. And I should add that cell differentiation creates different cell types. And what I will mean by cell type, if I say it, is cells that express largely different collections of their genes and therefore have largely different sets of proteins, in addition to those proteins that just basically run the cell. It has other meanings too. The second thing is that when the cells divide and form a sheet of cells, which is typically what happens early, the cells become different from each other and different types in particular patterns. And that's pattern formation. And so that goes beyond scalar to vectors. And then after pattern formation, once you have a sheet with a number of different types of cells, you go to morphogenesis, which is changing the shape of that sheet to serve the eventual function of the organ. And so you go from an individual cell level to a tissue, which is a collection of cells of different types with particular fractions of cells of different types and positions of cells with greater or lesser precision depending on the tissue. And then tissues together form organs after morphogenesis, and then the organs connect to each other in various physiological and physical ways, like your bones to your muscles, and that creates the organism. So there are a whole set of levels going from the cell, and we won't even touch on the subcellular levels. And so it's organized at a great many different levels, and what we're going to emphasize is pattern formation and morphogenesis. So we've got the problem of a linear DNA code and some other templates making a three-dimensional organism of one cell, making an organism with an extraordinarily large number of cells, with most or all of them in the right place and organs in the right shapes. And although there are various errors that occur in human development, you don't find people with a thumb where their eye should be or a toe where their elbow should be. organization is extremely robust, despite the fact that this is all happening at room temperature and over only a few months, and in the case of Arabidopsis, just a few days. So let's talk first about pattern formation, just very briefly, then about morphogenesis, very briefly, to get some of the terminology down, and then we'll talk about the differences between plants and animals. And then I'll give an example, one example of pattern formation and one example of morphogenesis in an animal or in a plant. And then I'll turn it over to Boris, who will take it from there in an animal and try and unify a field, which I'm going to try and fractionate as much as possible before he has the task of wrapping it all up. So let's talk about pattern formation. We have a sheet of cells. They're all theoretically of the same type. They're all descended from some common ancestor by division, and they're laid out there in some particular pattern. And there are two basic mechanisms by which a cell knows which type it should become. One is lineage, so that a mother cell, when it divides, could have daughter cells, which are fated to become particular cell types as a result of information they've received from the mother. And those lineage-based models, and by the way, these are not lineage and signaling between cells are our two alternatives. They both happen in lots of ways. There are very few systems where you can strictly say that one or the other is happening alone. So we begin with lineage, with Sidney Brenner, who is the late Sidney Brenner, who is a wag in molecular biology, termed the European plan, where your state and society is defined by your parents and your grandparents. And that type of development classically is called mosaic development. And the test for it is if you ablate a cell sometime in development, and if the cell types that would ordinarily be descended from that cell are missing in the final organism, then it's lineage-based, because it strictly depends on who your parentage was. Now, signaling is the alternative, where you have a group of cells that are more or less equivalent, and they start talking to each other, and between them they decide who's going to become which cell type and where they're going to do that. And it's this type of pattern formation that we're going to be talking about, and not the lineage-based type, which has more to do with inheritance of protein molecules from one generation to the other. So the question then is, how do you signal between cells such that some cells become one type, some cells become another type? And the basic concept here on which we're going to rely is one that was introduced by Turing in 1952, which is the concept of a morphogen, which is any sort of substance which is made by a cell or secreted by a cell and that signals other cells to do something. A very general definition by Turing. It's been redefined many times, but that was his definition, that it goes somewhere and it does something that makes cells become different types. And now these morphogens are always diffusible in the Turing thing, and so they can diffuse from a source out to the sink and out somewhere in the gradient that they form, above certain concentrations or in a certain range of concentrations, they can signal a cell to become a cell of a particular type as a result of signal transduction cascades in the cells that we won't talk about. Now, while Turing had his morphogens being strictly diffusible, some with inhibitory activities and some with activating activities, diffusing at different rates to give complex patterns in tissues, that's never really the case as far as I know it. They all do diffuse, everything diffuses, but in addition, there are always processes that have evolved that change the rate of diffusion or the limit of diffusion or the gradient of diffusion from a center, or even in the case which I'll talk about, that actively transport the morphogens in ways that are dynamic and highly controlled so that they go in particular directions, not strictly by diffusion. But of course, they're always diffusing at the same time. So wherever you send them, they're diffusing back and they're diffusing forward. I'll give a quick example just to clarify that before I get to the specific plant example, which is this, that supposing you have a diffusing molecule and it can diffuse between cells just passively, but it also gets taken up by the cells and then secreted again on the pathway. If you change you have something that degrades the signal in the cells and you control that rate of degradation, you can change the shape of the gradient, even though everything's diffusing because of the active degradation when it's in the cells before it gets sent out again. That's just an example. Okay, so morphogens can go to the next cell. Sometimes they go no farther because they're attached to a cell. Sometimes they can go off quite a long distance. That introduces two other things that I have to bring up. One is that while all this is going on, the cells are still dividing, typically, so that you have a tissue that's growing, and that, of course, creates a problem for the shape and the extent of the gradient, which we won't say much about, I don't think. Well, Boris might. And the other thing to recognize is that we've now gone beyond scalars because there's a direction of movement of these things which can create an array of cells of different types, so now we have a vector. Right. We'll get to the tensors in a second. Yeah?
Is cancer thought to be in special cases?
Yeah, it can be. I mean, there are aspects of it that are very much that way. But what happens when cancer is dangerous for you is something we haven't got to yet, which is that the cells don't always just sit in the tissue. Sometimes they get up and move. And when they do that and go to the wrong place and divide out of control, we have big problems. But they are always signaling. And some of those signals are really poorly understood. People who get cancer often die by starving to death, no matter how much they eat, because there's some sort of signaling between their ordinary organs that's being disrupted by signals that are coming from the tumors. And so this is very much involved and not fully understood in that case. All right, so we have now cells that can have polarity. They might have direction within the cell. They might know which side is which. They're still in a linear, a two-dimensional tissue, as I'm describing it, though of course there are three-dimensional cases. And then the next thing is we have to get to morphogenesis. Now, we can't confuse a morphogen, which is a diffusible substance, with morphogenesis, which results from the activity of morphogens, but the morphogens create different cell types. The different cell types can divide at different rates. They can have different shapes, they can grow to different sizes, they can have different mechanical and metabolic properties, and it's as a result of this that the shape of the tissue begins to change to make something like a hand or an eye. And so you usually start with a sheet of cells. The cells are in different types. The different types behave differently, and this, through mechanics, causes a change in the shape of the sheet, which we'll get into in some detail. And you eventually end up with cells in the right relative disposition to each other, the right numbers, and in an organ of the right shape. We won't talk about connecting the organs to each other. Okay, so plants and animals both do this. What are the differences between plants and animals? And the differences are big. Plants and animals evolved independently from a last common ancestor about 1.5 billion years ago, which was unicellular. There's little doubt about this. And that before that last common ancestor, there were a variety of events that occurred to create this common cell. And afterwards, one major event on the plant side is that a cyanobacterium, blue-green alga, was taken up by one of these lineages to provide it with photosynthesis. And those are the ones that have developed into plants, and the ones that don't have that extra organ that gives them photosynthesis, us, are parasites, because we can't create our own energy. We have to eat the other ones. And that's the animals. Now, that's an oversimplification of a lot of things, but that's where we are in a one-hour talk. So if we were to look at an animal tissue, our sheet of cells might look something like this. Physically, an animal tissue is something like a bunch of water balloons, which are stuck to each other, but not really stuck that great. They can slide around. They're often attached at the bottom to some sort of a membrane, but they can squeeze up and down in the sheet to make what's called a pseudostratified epithelium. They can reassort so that these two can squeeze together and these ones squeeze out of the way. And sometimes, in some tissues, often one of them will get up and walk away and go somewhere else, initiate some other process. And so you have the problems in cancer of that happening inappropriately, or when you wish it wouldn't. It's very soft. You can squeeze it with, I don't know, nanonewtons, micronewtons, something less than that. So it's like a bunch of rubber balloons. And so essentially, you have a very dynamic set of events that are occurring during differentiation and during pattern formation and during morphogenesis. Now, plant cells are very different. They have around them a solid wall, which is made of wood or something like wood. Wood is plant cell walls of a particular type. And inside, they have very high turgor pressure. There's a little bit of turgor pressure in the animal cells, so they stay inflated. But there's a lot of turgor pressure, maybe 10 atmospheres of turgor pressure in the plant cells, which is resisted by these solid walls that surround them. So the first thing is they're very stiff. They're at high tension, and the tension is being resisted by the walls, which are made of a bunch of proteins and largely sugar polymers of various different sorts, so that they're under high tension, while these are under more modest tension in the animals. When an animal cell divides, what normally happens is that it pinches off like this. It's squeezed in the middle to become two cells, while a plant cell just makes a new wall right across. And of course, there's continual expansion, and then this one might make a wall that way. And so, the plant cells never slide with respect to each other. They're absolutely fixed. The animal cells slide all the time. And so an animal tissue is like a bunch of water balloons, but a plant tissue is like a brick wall. And so the problem of development and morphogenesis here is to keep control of all the cells and to figure out who's going where as a biologist. The problem here is a problem the plant has. The biologist has no problem finding where the cells are. They don't go anywhere. But the plant has a problem of building a brick wall by inserting new bricks into the middle because it's stiff and nothing is slipping. And so let me give now an example from plants of pattern formation and of morphogenesis that will make concrete some of the principles that I just brought up, and then I'll turn it over to Boris. So the plants and animals, very different cells, very different processes of development. Oh, and one other thing importantly that I should say, since they evolved independently from a unicellular common ancestor, all of the processes of development are independently evolved in plants and animals, so that the molecules on the surface of animal cells and of plant cells are entirely different. The molecules that are used as morphogens are entirely different. I don't know of any common morphogen that's used by both plants and animals. Somebody probably knows one and can tell me, and I'd like to know it if you do. And that although in the middle of the cells, processes are very much the same, everything having to do with cell-cell communication, cell-cell adhesion, cell-cell signaling of any type, the nature of the morphogens, the way the morphogens move around, seems to be entirely different. So you have two entirely different systems of multicellular development, one from animals and one's in plants. And I'm going to leave it to Boris to bring all that back together. Let me give a couple of examples from plants of how these things work. So let me remind myself of what I want to draw. Now, we showed a shoot apical meristem before, which is a collection of stem cells that's at the top of a plant. Let's see. Let's do that and that. It's something like this. So here's our stem. And by stem cell, one means cells that will divide and give rise to other cells of different types, and that will continually divide for some long period of time. There are lots of meanings to that, too. And so we have up here a hemispherical area, which is called the shoot meristem, which consists of these stem cells, a few hundred of them, which are dividing all the time. On the flanks of the meristem, some collections of cells start to divide faster than others, and they lump out like that, eventually making a big lump like this, which in this case is a developing flower. The developing leaves also are the same way, but they're a little bit more linear. A developing leaf might look like this when it first forms. And so that in the periphery of the meristem, we get organs forming, which are either floral primordia or leaf primordia, depending on when it is in the life of the plant. And then those grow out and become those complicated leaves or flowers, while these cells in the meristem continually provide for new flowers or new leaves, and cells in the middle of the meristem divide and provide for additional stem material, different from stem cells, so that the meristem is always going up and it's at the top of the stem. Yeah.
Is there anything in what you say that explains why animals so often have bilateral symmetry and plants don't?
Well, plant leaves have bilateral symmetry. The floral organs have bilateral symmetry. but the whole plant doesn't have bilateral symmetry, that's all.
Could you repeat the question?
The question was whether there's anything in what I've said that would explain why animals have bilateral symmetry and plants don't. But plants do, just not usually. I mean, some of them do at the whole organism level too, like a traveler palm. That's bilaterally symmetric. But leaves are bilaterally symmetric, and floral organs are. So they both have bilateral symmetry. All right. So we have our meristem, which is a collection of cells that are always dividing, and they're making flowers. Now we're all familiar with pine cones and sunflowers. So if we look at our meristem down from the top, and we think about how a pine cone or a sunflower is, we're thinking about phyllotactic pattern, the pattern in which successive leaves or successive flowers are made one after the other. And so if we make a flower here that we'll call flower one, in a typical spiral phyllotaxis, about 130 or 140 degrees around from that would be flower two, and then flower three would be another 140, and then flower four, and then flower five, and so on. And so what I want to talk about is this pattern, which is pattern formation in a growing domain of cells. And we're only going to talk about the epidermal cells because that's where it happens. So we have a sheet of cells that are underlain by other cells that we won't talk about yet that somehow creates this spiral pattern, which makes something as lovely as a pine cone or the middle of a sunflower, or in a more modest way, in a Rhabdopsis plant. How does this work? And the answer to how this works comes from a morphogen. Our morphogen is called auxin. It was first proposed to exist in the 1880s by Darwin and by von Sachs. It was shown to exist as a chemical by Wendt in 1926, and it's been around ever since. It's indole-3 acetic acid, so it's related to tryptophan, the amino acid, and it's a small molecule that can diffuse freely in the cell walls of a plant cell. And I should point out that these cell walls are about, in a meristem, they're about 80 to 100 nanometers thick. So they're thin, but there's plenty of room there for things to diffuse around. And they're not particularly tight. Small molecules can diffuse around in them just fine. So what's happening here? We have auxin, and this is where we introduce an aspect of polarity, and as I'll tell you, regulated transport of a morphogen. So this is our morphogen. The way it works is that whenever auxin gets to a high enough concentration, it induces, by changing gene activity patterns through a nuclear receptor that it has, the formation of a new flower. And one of the first things that it does when it does that is cause the cells to start to divide more rapidly. And then there are various gene activity changes that create the different parts of the flower, one after the other. And so how is it that auxin gets to a high concentration at this position, then this one, then this one, then this one? And that's a problem in pattern formation. And in fact, it's the problem that Turing was working on, trying to explain with morphogens in 1954 when he killed himself. Auxin has a special property. All morphogens have some special property, but no other ones have this special property that I know of, which is that if you have a couple of plant cells or some group of plant cells like this, where there are walls between them, and I made them very schematically square here, auxin, which is indole acetic acid, is ionized when it's inside the cells because the pH is 7 and the pK of IAA is about 5 or 5.5. And this ion cannot go through a plasma membrane, which surrounds each cell, and therefore can't get out into the cell wall and diffuse. It's trapped. However, when there's auxin outside the cell, where the pH is lower because of the action of some proton pumps in the plasma membranes, IAA can go straight back into the cell. So it can't get out, but it can go in. Now, there's a set of proteins that can allow it out. Auxin efflux carriers coded by a gene, the one I'll talk about is called pinformed-1, for the obvious reason that when you mutate it, you don't get any flower primordia, so the meristem just sticks up like a pin. And if you have some pinform-1 protein on this side of the cell, then the IAA can get out. Once it's out there, it can go into the next cell, or it can go back into the cell where it started, no problem, because it can diffuse back in. So if you have an asymmetric disposition of this auxin efflux carrier, you can create a net flux of auxin in the tissue. So that if you have a situation like this, where the pin one is always at, I should use another color. Destroy all your chalk. The pin one is always at an end like this. Then the once the auxin gets into this cell, it can only go out at this end. Some of it can come back, but some of it can go there. Once it's in here, it can only go out at that end. And you create a net flux of auxin. And so we've established an aspect of polarity in the shoot apical meristem. So we've gone from our scalar expression level of pin one to our vector, the asymmetric disposition of pin one in a cell, so we can create a net flux. And what happens, in brief, in kilotaxis, is that there's an active, a dynamic process of reallocation of the pin one to the cells, so that initially, awesome. Did I lose my microphone?
Yes, I hear about this stuff.
That's good. This will be cryptic to the people online then. I like that. So that, yeah. We can get to that. We probably won't get to that. We surely won't get to that, but I'd be happy to talk to you about it later. But there's a couple of things. Well, a major one is actually physical stress on the walls, but I'm not even going to get to that. So that initially, the auxin goes in towards this. It's transported towards the site. And indeed, we'll say in a second where it's transported from. But after a while, the pin one reverses and it starts to send the auxin back again. And the same as happens for two. We're talking about maintenance of a pattern. The origin of the pattern is rather different, and we can get to that. So initially, the auxin goes in, then it comes back out. And what happens successively is, since this starts to project its auxin out first, this starts to project it out second, the highest concentration of auxin is reached here next. Then this one and this one project the auxin out, and the place where it reaches highest concentration is over here, where those two streams meet, and you get the next one, and so on. So first the auxin goes in, being sent there from the older developing flowers, and then it goes out, where it creates the next developing flower. So that's an example of pattern formation that uses a morphogen that has regulated transport. So it's regulated transport of a morphogen. There are many other ways that morphogen diffusion and movement is altered in developing tissues, and we'll hear about one more. And now let me finish up by just talking about morphogenesis. What we showed over here was that we have a meristem consisting of cells with these projecting out. How is it that these shapes change? Now what happens is that the epidermis, the outer layer of cells here, is under tension because its turgor pressure is the turgor pressure of the cells underneath it are not fully resisted by their walls. So that last set of cells is blown up like a balloon. Hence, it's a thin-walled pressure vessel, and we can calculate the stress patterns. The stress patterns where it's hemispherical are isotropic, and the tension between the cells is equal. But if you start to divide a bunch of cells faster in one particular place because of the higher concentration of the morphogen, the stress pattern changes such that across this, if we do a cross-section with a flower primordium, a meristem, and a younger flower primordium, the tension's isotropic here, but it's strongly anisotropic through these saddle points with their negative Gaussian curvature. Could even theoretically be compressional, orthogonal to the saddle direction. And so that you have a pattern of stresses which are natural and an inevitable consequence of the tension in the epidermis and the shape of the organ. As it happens, the cell walls reinforce themselves through processes I don't have time to talk about, so that cellulose fibers are laid down parallel to the principal direction of maximal stress. And cellulose is that component of the wall, which is A, anisotropic, and B, has a very high elastic modulus. So it prevents the wall from stretching once it's been laid down in the stress direction. So once the cell experiences its thin wall pressure vessel stress, maybe across here, the cellulose fibers align this way, and the cells can only expand orthogonally to the direction of the cellulose fibers because their modulus is much higher than the gel in which they sit. And so you get expansion in this direction of these cells, which leads to a new shape, which leads to a new stress pattern, which leads to subsequent pattern of expansion. And so just like Wheeler's description of Einstein's theory of gravitation, where he says that space tells matter how to move and matter tells space how to curve, we have here that stress tells cellulose how to align and cellulose tells the cells how to grow. And so we have a stress feedback that leads from a uniform planar field with a morphogen in it, whereby differential activity of the sites where the morphogen reaches highest concentration and this stress feedback, it changes its shape and eventually reaches the shape of a meristem and a flower. So we fully explain plant pattern formation and morphogenesis. And at that, I'll leave it to Boris and answer one question.
You seem to have started your lecture with the dichotomy between plant and animal as either or structure.
Yes.
Is there anything that you said sort of exclude life forms that could be both animals and plants or neither?
No, I haven't said anything that would exclude it. I can't think of any examples. But I mean, there are lichens that are half fungi and half plants, and sometimes they have bacteria too. So there are these sort of symbiotic life forms. But I don't know of anyone that's plant and animal. Although I always thought, you know, if I ran out of grant money, I would find some way to put chloroplast into humans, and people on the east side and in San Francisco would be a fad, and they would lie outside and generate sugar for lunch. But so far the grant money's still coming in. I better give you the microphone.
Okay. So the first week of our program, we had a bunch of introductory lectures and we had some people introducing animal development, and then we had Elliot introducing plant development, and he came out and he said, well, forget everything that you learned. So I really contrived to speak after Elliot, so I'd get to say the same thing. But but of course the truth is that he was joking then, and I'm joking now. So really remember everything that he said, even though I erased it. But let's completely switch gears for a moment, and I'm going to start by talking about fly leg development. And it starts during the larval stage in the form that doesn't even vaguely remind you, not even vaguely reminiscent of a leg. It's so a structure inside the larva called imaginal disc. And it's called a disc because it looks like a disc. Now, the leg itself, of course, doesn't look like a disc at all. This is going to be my rendition of a fly leg. It has a bunch of segments, and very crudely, these different segments are distinguished. So cells in these different segments were fated to become this or that part of the leg by virtue of expressing certain genes. So G1, I'm sparing you the names that I don't remember, G2, G3, sort of different genes, and if you trace back where these genes were expressed in a disc, so this is supposed to be an adult, you'll find that so the most distal part of the leg has the genes that were expressed in sort of the center region of the disc. And then there is this concentric pattern of gene expression. And that's the pattern that is seen during the larval stage. And all I'm doing is I'm retelling you the story discovered by Tamali Kui sitting in front of me as a graduate student a long time ago. And the most interesting part of the story, well, the story had many interesting parts, is that this pattern of gene expression was set up by, guess what? Morphogens. So those diffusible substances that emanated from regions where these substances were expressed, produced, and secreted. So one happens to be called, wrong one, wingless, sorry, wrong color code, very bad. Wingless, another one called decapentaplegic. You'll be quizzed later. You might ask, how on earth you get a pattern like this from sources like that? That's somewhat non-trivial, but we believe that this happens because the expression of this G1 requires high levels of both wingless and DPP, and those high levels of wingless would be found in this region, and the high level of DPP would be found in this region, and there you go, where you have the overlap, you got this gene expressed. And so it goes. So this lays out the pattern for us. The key thing, of course, is that in order to generate from here to there, this shape from this pattern, we need a major transformation of shape and form, and this is accomplished by growth, which is somehow encoded in this pattern, and in addition, active change of cell shapes. Right, and all of this is happening during metamorphosis.
Or is the
yeah.
Left mostly two-dimensional?
Yeah, it's a disk, it's a two-dimensional surface. And it's also effectively monolayer of epithelial cells, so quite remarkable. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about this active part of change of cell shapes. So let's look at cell scale. So I'm going to zoom in on cells. So here, I'm not going to draw many cells, four cells. And their mechanical, their shape and mechanical properties are largely determined by actomyosin fibers. And that form cortical cytoskeleton consists of these actin fibers that are lining the sides of the cell. And they're cross-linked by myosins. Myosins are motors. They can walk and contract the structure. And these cytoskeletal bundles between the cells are linked by adhesion molecules that glue cells together. Okay, so that was myosin. And yet another thing that makes animals different from plants, plants don't have myosin. Oh, okay, no more. yeah, no, of course they do. Of course, how stupid is that? I know, it's even single. Okay, sorry. Well, they don't have a cytoskeleton like this. So anyway, I stand corrected. So another interesting thing for us is so the phenomenon of planar cell polarity. So Elliot was talking about cell-cell signaling. So planar cell polarity is all about cells signaling to their neighbors, and they signal by having ligands on the surface, and these ligands bind to receptors on the outer surface, and some of these signals and receptors have a property of phase separating in such a way that you get kind of a polarized interface, and then this polarization can propagate from cell to cell. So already you see this polarization vector right here pointing towards these blue arrows. And cells use this polarization for all sorts of purposes. For example, they grow hairs like this. And so the hairs here are aligned basically by virtue of this planar cell polarization of epithelium. Okay, so let's start putting these processes together. So we have morphogens control gene expression as a function of position. And we have this planar cell polarity, PCP. So we have planar cell polarity, which is instructed, this polarization is instructed by gradients in morphogens and, of course, by the territories where certain genes are expressed. And what is this? Morphogens. Okay. Morphogens also serve as growth factors. So they control growth. And of course, genes also regulate growth because it matters which part is going to grow by how much. And very importantly, another thing that these things have to regulate in addition to growth is this active cell shape transformation. And this planar cell polarity is important because it actually also defines anisotropy within the tissue. And for example, this planar cell polarity can instruct one or the other interface within the cell to contract. So it can generate ordered, large-scale transformation of cell shapes. So planar cell polarity will act here, and furthermore, it's going to make growth and shape transformation potentially anisotropic. And last but not least, growth, especially if it's non-uniform and anisotropic, is going to generate mechanical stress and deformation. And Elliot was already talking about that. Excuse me. One of the very important things that Elliot told us was that if in this complicated diagram you detect some flow of information from here into stress and deformation, well, forget that, because stress can actually feed back onto flux of morphogens. Elliot gave a very direct example with auxin and perhaps gene expression, and also deformation, so the geometry of the tissue, we might expect, may also have an effect on what is exposed to these morphogens and what is not. So there is a feedback due to mechanical stress and tissue geometry. So in trying to start tying things together, let me draw a little diagram, excuse me, a little table here. And my table is going to have what I'll define as morphogenetic fields. And we'll talk about plants, and we'll talk about animals. And these morphogenetic fields are the patterns in the tissue. And what kind of patterns have we seen? We've seen scalars. So, for example, right, morphogens here, auxin is a scalar. And in animals, I said wingless DPP and a long list of other morphogens. Well, you know, there are also more sort of morphogenetically active compounds in molecules in plants as well. And then, of course, gene expression, right? There are lots of genes, so lots of scalars as a function of position. And the same thing happens in plants and animals. Next category is going to be vectors. So pin one, that transporter of auxin is a vector. So it effectively defines a vector field through the tissue. And we better know what that vector field looks like. Similarly, planar cell polarity that I talked about also defines a vector field through the tissue. And we want to know about it. And the story doesn't stop there. There are tensors. And cell shape and isotropy is described by a tensor. Growth, in principle, doesn't have to be isotropic. It's also, well, in fact, the cell division already is intrinsically anisotropic, right? Because there has to be a cleavage axis. We have to decide which way the cells are going to divide. And so it's naturally described by a tensor. What else is a tensor? Stress is a tensor. Meissen distribution. Meissen. Where is Meissen? So Meissen is naturally associated with little edges. So it's associated with filaments. So distribution of Meissen will have to be expressed in terms of little filaments and how they are oriented in space. And yet another tensor. So anyway, so I guess how do I show that all of this is actually in common? And now our picture is that there's a 2D pattern of scalar, vector, and tensor morpho fields. And and that is going to determine the 3D shape. And so this is a dynamical process, right? It involves growth. So there is dynamics involved here. And both Elliot and I already advertised that even though this, we like to think that 2D pattern is prescribed and determines sort of the growth and everything that will define the 3D shape, there's actually a feedback running in part through mechanical. Okay, so let's just call it feedback. And it goes through mechanics and geometry. Well, if you phrase the question like this, then the answer is certainly yes, right? Because you're saying, is there some condition under which, and in biology, most certainly we can find an example where that might be true. But can I escape with that? all right. So, but in remaining 5 minutes, let me try to tell you a little bit more about how we think about going from this 2D pattern to 3D shape. And the clarity of thinking on that really came from thinking about plants. And Eliot already gave us the essential intuition. So let's talk about growth and form. And particularly, let's talk about non-uniform and anisotropic growth and form. So if you have a disk and for some reason it grows faster, so fast growth, in the center, it's going to, right, so think of this as an elastic sheet. And somehow you get the material in the center to expand. And in fact, this has been done by our soft matter physics friends. So that will generate kind of a spherical cap, right? So surface has to deform to generate more area to accommodate extra growth. On the other hand, if you have an opposite situation, so more growth on the periphery, that's going to generate a saddle kind of a shape. You see how fast I can grow? Draw a saddle. Is that a saddle? Yeah, more or less. No, it's not. Never mind. So think of a surface of negative curvature. So positive curvature here and negative curvature there. And we can understand this pretty much in terms of generalized elasticity. So generalized elasticity. And it's a very simple generalization. So think first of a Hookean spring. So Mr. Hook has us think about a little spring of a given length. And the elastic energy is the length minus the intrinsic length of that unstretched spring squared stiffness. So we have this notion of an intrinsic length of a spring. So now let's generalize this to two dimensions. So we have a 2D elastic sheet, and there are some intrinsic coordinates. Now there are some coordinates on the surface here. Let me call these coordinates x1 and x2. And the question is, and this is embedded in 3D. So there is some 3D position of a point on the surface that depends on x1 and x2. And the question is, what is the length of a little infinitesimal element here? So this dl squared is given by the metric. So this is the embedding metric, which relates so the actual so length of an element to the intrinsic coordinates here. So now Gauss, in his remarkable theorem, so Theorema Egregium, taught us that this metric defines the geometry by defining Gaussian curvature. And if the Gaussian curvature is defined, except for some exceptions that we don't have time to talk about, specifying Gaussian curvature will specify the shape. Okay, and here comes the generalized elasticity. So now replace this by a little expression involving embedding metric and an intrinsic metric. Now I got a little expression. These are tensors. I have to properly contract them and integrate them over the surface. And this is now our generalized elasticity for the sheet. And what's interesting about this generalized elasticity is that it has now this intrinsic metric, which basically tells the embedding metric what it ought to be to minimize the energy, right? If embedding metric, if the surface has the correct shape, which means have the shape defined by the intrinsic metric, then this elastic energy is minimized. And so what has this all to do with that? And what it has to do with that is that the time derivative of the intrinsic metric is the growth rate tensor. So if you like, that's the unified theory of plant and animal morphogenesis, because all of this that you learned here goes into defining this growth anisotropy. Growth anisotropy defines the rate of change of this intrinsic metric. It tells this epithelial sheet how to embed itself in three dimensions, and that's how you make shape. Right? Now, of course, the devil is in the detail, as usual, and in order to arrive at this level of simplicity, a lot of things had to be swept under the rug, right? For example, back to this now erased fly leg, I told you that actually it was formed during morphogenesis, and during morphogenesis there wasn't so much growth, it was the change of shape, right? So if you're sort of a stickler for detail and you say, well, you know, it doesn't grow, then you say, well, these are very different phenomena. But if you zoom out, then you'll say, well, actually, change of cell shape is described by a tensor field. And it's another thing that can define so a change in this intrinsic metric. So you can start, you know, using this very crude framework to unify different phenomena, at least in a way that you think about it. And so in order to discover this unity, we had, in fact, to look at many systems at the same time, right? To build this bridge. And on the other hand, well, you know, never mind some magic little equations. Sort of stepping aside and trying to unify different systems has other benefits. So, for example, somewhere here, you know, in my mind, I had this perfectly arranged blackboard that I was going to end up with. This did not happen. So. we're talking about so the feedback due to feedback of stress back onto patterning. And the truth is that it is much more evident in plants than it is in animals. So by learning from plants and thinking if we meaning animals, have similar phenomena, well, we might actually discover something. And Lars is standing up and I'm finishing. Elliot, please.
It's neither. It's the fact that we vastly oversimplified the biological world. And there are lots of things that are neither plants nor animals. Yeah. And some of them don't do things like this. I mean, there are giant single cells that have very complicated shapes. And so that all the intrinsic metric is in a single cell wall, not shape changes in different cells. And with an hour, that's sucked it out.
No, Elliot, don't sit down. Don't sit down.
It's your turn.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
The question is, why do humans not grow new limbs?
Is this an animal question?
It's an animal question, yeah. Newts do, so you can trigger it.
Question.
We think. Yeah, there's a limit, but you could regenerate a limb starting with a little thing, like newts do.
Well, so, you know, so diffusion is, of course, a limitation, right? But, you know, that sort of limits the time scale, so how fast you can do it. But presumably, large scale, in any case, it would be active transport, and right, biology will have a way of getting around that.
Or you
that
could
limit.
Do it at the small scale and then grow it. Like, expansion in the universe. Yeah, sure. So, yeah, there's no reason you can't specify it in any scale you want.
Question? I'm sure that they would say no, but if I look at the organization of tissues, compare animals to plants, it seems to me that the animals always have one extra direction. For example, what in a tissue is a row of cells. In animals, it's a sheaf of cells, but it's a sheaf of cells in plants, and animals it's a few plants. So assuming I'm not totally wrong, which you'll probably say yes, is the order of the tensor different when you compare, say, a plant within a particular structure and an animal cell and a fluid structure? Is the order of the tensor different?
So Boris, you want to repeat the question?
Well, I think,
like, understand the question.
Yeah. I'm not entirely sure I understood the question, but I'm going to rephrase it in such a way that I understand it. So we were only talking about 2D sheets. And of course the relevant question is, so why 2D and not 3D? So I think the answer is twofold. It's easier to study systems that are sort of stratified so that they're 2D, so that we know more about them, right? Which doesn't mean that there aren't sort of 3D, sort of truly 3D context. So in fact, I think mammalian development involves sort of growth in 3D, not in 2D. And then so the non-trivial question is to what extent we can still think of it as sort of 2D pattern, sort of slightly generalized, or is it really, truly three-dimensional pattern? Did I? Kind of.
Leon, so I'm always struck in these biology talks how there's a flowering of complications, and my eyes glaze over a little bit as a hardcore physicist, but at the end, transition to, you know, relatively fancy math, And I wonder how it, is there a way to sort of cycle back and have some, you know, experimental test implication in specific example or your final half equation?
Yeah. Absolutely. So we started out with that movie of a little shrimp developing, and I said, so the nice thing about that shrimp is that you can actually visualize this outgrowth of a limb as it starts right, basically from the flat whatever it is shell of the embryo, and in that case is pretty clearly driven by differential growth, which furthermore is anisotropic, right? And you literally can you know, track cells and identify who divided when and how. So you have full resolution of this, I mean, full resolution at cellular level, right? And then you can start asking how this anisotropic growth actually maps into the shape. And Dylan in the back there, a graduate student here, that, you know, that's what he's doing. And our question is the following. So Gauss actually taught us that perfectly isotropic growth would suffice for defining essentially an arbitrary embedding of a sheet in 3D. And that's not what Prayali is doing. That shrimp is actually growing anisotropically. And the question is, who ordered that, right? Biology is, for some reason, is using three components of a tensor, right? So the full tensor instead of just one. So it's definitely possible to link it. I don't know the answer.
Hang on a second, Eric. I was going to ask you, as one puts these concepts together, as one puts these concepts together quantitatively, do the timescales, I mean, are there timescale questions, or do timescales seem to agree how long things should take? In other words, and that's a quantitative question for, I suppose, detailed modeling, but just in general, timescales for development, as you put together these ideas,
well, they're certainly puzzles, but yes, they generally match, and that a lot of the dynamism in timescales of the different processes actually creates some of the pattern. It's really important to keep the timescales in mind. But yeah, I don't think there's any problems. Diffusion can be very slow, but there's always something that gooses it, where it's happening over
you
a very small domain.
Neither of you did any electrical signaling.
No, I can't. There is. I mean, there's ion signaling. Yeah, there's we didn't go through the whole world of
okay.
signaling. Yeah,
okay.
There's lots of signals.
Sorry, over here.
Yeah.
Please, there was some discussion about cell shapes and how they move in the first part of the presentation, and we also talked about cancer. But I was wondering, the whole thing made me think if plants also can get cancer.
Yes, they get cancer, but since the cells never move, they don't have metastasis,
okay.
So they end up with a tumor, which in here in Northern California people turn into coffee tables called galls. That gives me the creeps. But it's but they're not lethal or anything because they don't go anywhere. But sure they do, yeah.
Sorry. Boris, my question is part of related to the you started with nice biological pictures and so on, and you end up with what he calls a relatively sophisticated influence.
Let's worry about it offline.
Okay. Well, I'm trying to ask this. The mathematics can be generalized here. So it oftentimes it can be generalized to higher dimensionality in physics in many ways. Is there any equivalent to dimensionalizing with higher dimensions in biology? I know it must sound. Even crazier than string theory, but is there some way to think about it since the mathematics can generalize?
I don't think we've ever got past the usual three space and one time that I know of. What do you say, Boris?
Sorry, I...
Mark, go ahead.
Yeah.
If you look at the statistical mechanics of membranes, then there's a technique where the embedding dimension is taken very large, because the power block is difficult. In perturbation theory, you could resum infinite number of diagrams of large dimension, just like the large M expansion in quantum field. So that technique is used make predictions, non-perturbative predictions about physical mechanics.
Okay, I think we should wrap up here. Thanks, everybody. Thanks.